calculations show that with such a structure, I could reach across the Pacific. Tesla told White that because of the limitations on capital, he would have to fall back on an older design involving the use of two and possibly three towers, but much smaller. The design would be the same, only the dimensions would be reduced. "I shall make some calculations," the inventor concluded, "to see how far I can reduce the height without impairing materially the efficiency of the apparatus, and will communicate with you as soon as practicable." The following day, Tesla wrote White again, agreeing to construct a tower with a height of approximately 150 feet. Having worked with figures on a tower 600 feet high in May, Tesla probably reduced it by half by the time he saw Morgan in August, and then in half again after White told him that the costs of a 300-foot tower were prohibitive. Adding the figure of 1/6 larger, which he mentioned to White in his last letter, or 25 feet, we come to 150 plus 25 or 175 feet, which was just about the height of the actual tower. After construction, it was 187 feet. However, Tesla also constructed a well beneath the tower with an accompanying spiral staircase, which ran 10 stories below the ground to a depth of 120 feet. Adding this figure to the total, i.e. 187 plus 120, we come to a length of approximately 300 feet, or one-half the size of the original plan, and therefore in a harmonic relationship to it. Even this tower, however, was too expensive to build, given the cost of the machinery, complex design of the housing, which required that it be fireproof, and the inflation produced by the crash. In pondering these letters, it becomes apparent that Tesla was not too perturbed by the assassination of the president. Self-engulfed, he was utterly amblyopic when it came to negotiating with Morgan, a man enmeshed in two potentially epic crises and one history-altering tragedy. Theodore Roosevelt, who now became president, was not a man who was going to be particularly kind to big business. To say that Tesla blundered here would be an understatement. His decision to alter his contract without telling Morgan, and his resolution to proceed with the grand vision when he knew that his funds would be inadequate, were addle-brained. One suspects that once Tesla had signed a contract with the greatest financial force on the planet, a deep-seated subconscious complex was triggered, involving an impatient, egomaniacal streak that forced the inventor to place everything on the line when he should have proceeded in a more discerning way. Incapable of compromising and at risk of self-obliteration, Tesla began construction of the tower after his falling out with Morgan. On the positive side, the inventor knew that he was in a race against pirates and for what he perceived as the Holy Grail, his peerless notch in history. Undaunted, the courageous inventor moved ahead with the conviction that his path was right and that he could not fail. Tesla's seemingly foolhardy decision must be understood in the light of the fact that fortunes had already been reaped on his former inventions by Morgan and others. By 1901, for instance, Morgan's General Electric Company was actually producing more induction motors than the Westinghouse Corporation. Morgan was involved, along with Westinghouse, in instituting an electric subway system in the bowels of Manhattan based on Tesla's polyphase system. And then, of course, there was Niagara Falls. Every home in the world was going to be illuminated by Tesla's system. The revenues pouring into the electric power companies for this new technology were staggering, but Tesla received not a cent. One way or another, he felt that Morgan should give him carte blanche. It was a bleak autumn for the inventor when the ground was broken for the 18-story edifice, Tesla now naming it his magnifying transmitter. Although mostly constructed of wood, 50 tons of iron and steel were also used, along with 50,000 bolts. Taking into account the amount of lumber it took to line the well and build the staircase down, and the difficulty of digging it, one begins to visualize the enormous expenditures that were going to be involved. W.D. Crowe stayed in charge of construction. Hoping for the best, Tesla wrote to Catherine on October the 13th. "My dear Mrs. Johnson, 13 is my lucky number, and so I know you will comply with my wish to come to the Waldorf. And if you do, when I transmit my wireless messages across seas and continents, you will get the finest bonnet ever made if it breaks me. I have already ordered a simple lunch, and you must come en masse. We must exhibit Hobson. I know he likes me better than you. Nikola Tesla, electrical engineer and inventor. In November, the inventor tried once again to approach Morgan, setting up a meeting at 23 Wall Street and bringing a succinct list of his latest patent assignments and his report on how the construction was going. "Dear Mr. Morgan, pardon me for trespassing on your valuable time. The practical significance of my system resides in the fact that the effects transmitted diminishes only in a simple ratio with the distance, whereas in all other systems it is reduced in proportion to the square. To illustrate, if the distance be increased 100-fold, I get 1/100th of the effect, while under the same conditions others can obtain at the very best 1/10,000th of the effect. This feature alone bars all competition. In regard to other advantages, there are only two ways possible of economically utilizing the energy transmitted, either storing it in dynamic form, as for instance the energy of well-timed thrusts is stored in a pendulum, or by accumulating it in potential form, as for example compressed air is stored in a reservoir. My rights through patents on both are fundamental. Referring particularly to telegraphy and telephone, I have still in the Patent Office two applications pending. In one, I describe and claim discoveries relating to the transmission of signals through the earth to any distance, no matter how great, and in the other, a new principle which secures absolute privacy of messages and also enables the simultaneous transmission of any desired number of messages up to many thousands through the same channel, be it the earth or a wire or a cable. On this latter principle, I have applied for patents in the chief foreign countries. I consider these inventions of extreme commercial importance. Hoping that I shall be able to satisfy you that your generosity and confidence in me have not been misplaced, I remain yours very respectfully, N. Tesla. Morgan's continuing mistreatment of the inventor and lack of acknowledgement of the significance of the plans revealed were almost too much to bear. Tesla could not face the Johnsons or anybody for Thanksgiving, and so declined their invitation. "Dear Luca," Tesla wrote, "kindly excuse and remember me with kind regards." Signing the letter, "Nicola, far away." Newfoundland. Signor Marconi had been commuting regularly between England and the States throughout this period, looking for sites to place his wireless stations. Prime locations included the eastern tip of Long Island, Martha's Vineyard, and Cape Cod. In September 1901, the new equipment, including the immensely powerful transmitter, was installed at Poldhu, England, and a great 200-foot diameter ring of masts 200 feet high had risen like a huge skeleton on the edge of the cliff. Test transmissions to other Marconi stations, in particular that at Crookhaven Island, over 200 miles away, had shown that the waves did, at least to this extent, follow the curvature of the earth and not fly off into space. Across the Atlantic at Cape Cod, the twin station was similarly nearing completion, and plans were made with quiet optimism for the experiment to take place in a few weeks' time. In September, gale-force winds leveled the aerial in Poldhu, and in November the same thing occurred on the Cape. Tenaciously, Marconi pressed on, gambling with a less powerful but sturdier transmitter in England, and abandoning the idea of constructing a twin in the States. Instead, the Italian would try simply to intercept the signals of the English transmitter by fashioning an aerial with kites, high-altitude weather balloons, and a sensitive coherer as a receiver. On December the 6th, he landed with a small crew in Newfoundland, Canada, and floated up his receiving antenna on a spot designated appropriately as Signal Hill. December the 12th was chosen as the day for the experiment. The beacon selected, dot, 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 the Morse code for the letter S. On Friday the 13th, during a lull in a miserable storm of hail and rain, three faint taps were heard on his equipment. The world was rocked. Guglielmo Marconi's name was irrefutably carved into the history books. The age of mass communication had begun. 32. The Passing of the Torch, 1902. December 1901. Signor Marconi has scored a shrewd coup. Whether or not the three dots he heard came from England, or like those Tesla heard from Mars, if I am aught a prophet, We will hear no more of transatlantic messages for some time. Lee de Forest. Embittered, Tesla knew that Marconi's achievement was predicated on the use of his coil, oscillators, and general design, which he had spelled out in lectures years earlier. Preece assumed partial culpability, as he had requested from Tesla the use of this equipment for the work. But Marconi had announced that the Tesla apparatus was unnecessary and ineffectual, and this had caused a rift in the Italian's relationship with Preece. Fleming, on the other hand, having studied Tesla's work in earnest ever since he had received the inventor at his home in London in 1892, saw no such conflict. For it was he who arranged for Marconi the transmitting plant at Pulju. Tesla revealed many years later, Marconi had declared that wireless communication across the Atlantic was impossible because there was a wall of water several miles high between the two continents which the rays could not traverse. But subsequent developments showed that he had used my system in secret all the time, received the plaudits of the world, and accepted stolidly even my own congratulations, and it was only a long time after that he admitted it. Thomas Comerford Martin arrived at his office on Monday, December the 16th, to review the astonishing report from Newfoundland. With only Marconi and one aide as a witness, and the plans having been kept secret until the deed was accomplished, many doubted the Italian's proclamation. Professor Sylvanus Thompson of Great Britain suggested that Marconi had probably received static caused by severe weather conditions. One of Martin's colleagues concurred, "It's a fake. Such a thing cannot be done." "I think I should seek another opinion," the editor said as he put in a call to Tom Edison. "Very doubtful. How's it going to get around that blasted curve?" came Edison's hedging response. Martin dialed up Mikhail Pupin. "Professor, do you believe Marconi's transmission is genuine?"
"I most certainly do."
"Then I think we ought to celebrate it." It was the dead of winter when Tesla ducked out of the Waldorf Astoria as the new crowning electrical savant checked in. Tesla probably went to Wardenclyffe to stare at the first tier of the tower, which was finally under construction. With the temperature so cold, it was just one more annoyance to slow down progress. With only a few days to prepare, Martin was able to book the Astor Gallery at the Waldorf for the banquet on Monday, January the 13th, 1902. With 300 guests arriving, the task of arranging all the particulars put him in a frenzied state. He brushed by fantastic pictures of a wizard's laboratory as he hurried out the door. The hall was decorated with a large map of the Atlantic placed on the wall and a festoon of wires with clusters of three lights blinking dot, 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 strung between large tablets reading Signal Hill in Newfoundland and Pulju in England. Around the room, each table had its own model transmission tower, nameplates, and Italian olive-green menus on cardstock with pen and ink drawings of the transatlantic accomplishment. At the upper dais, in the middle was a medallion with Mr. Marconi's portrait, draped with the Italian flag. American and British flags and pendants for the AIEE and the Italian coat of arms were also placed there. At fitting times, the lights were flashed to the applause of the audience, and to cap off the dinner for dessert, a procession of waiters came marching in with ice cream embedded in ice carvings of incandescent lamps, ships at sea, electric vehicles, and wireless telegraph towers. The four-foot gnome trimmed his goatee and checked his gold pocket watch before smiling at himself once more in the mirror as he departed for the affair. Although he rocked from side to side when he walked, Charles Proteus Steinmetz developed a new swagger, for he had just been elected to the presidency of the AIEE. He was about to receive an honorary doctorate from Harvard and a professorship in engineering from Union College, located near GE headquarters in Schenectady, New York. The college appointment enabled Steinmetz to divide his time between academia and the corporate world. During the six-hour train ride down to the city, the abstract mathematician carefully read through galleys of his opus on AC, which was about to be republished in a larger format by McCraw-Hill. It was a small matter to the preeminent scholar that he had removed the name of his co-author and had continued the practice of eliminating reference to the source of his work, the inventions, researches, and writings of Nikola Tesla. Electricians, he rationalized, would be more interested in his advanced concepts than in knowing who first investigated the phenomena. By 1907, Steinmetz would lead in establishing the AIEE Code of Ethics. Who was Tesla anyway? Marconi was the man of the hour. At the upper dais sat a gaggle of Tesla adversaries. Aside from the new president, there was Professor Pupin, now financially tied to Marconi. Elihu Thompson, who claimed priority on the invention of the AC motor and Tesla coil. Carl Hering, who had backed Dobrovolsky in priority discussions of the inventor of long-distance AC transmission. William Stanley, who had pirated the Tesla Westinghouse induction motor and was now producing them legally for GE. Frank Sprague, who gained his reputation in part as the inventor of the electric railroad, when in fact it was all part of Tesla's AC polyphase system. T.C. Martin, who was still angry about past monies owed for sale of the inventor's collected works, and, of course, Guglielmo Marconi, the chap who had beaten him to the punch. Tesla's decision not to attend created an excellent atmosphere for gaiety and for perpetuating Steinmetz's published position of relegating the pioneer to the category of non-person. Others present at the infamous upper dais included Alexander Graham Bell and general counsels from Great Britain and Italy. And around the hall were Josh Wetzler, D. McFarlane Moore, many of the men's wives, and Mrs. Thomas Alva Edison, who was representing her husband. Martin presided over the occasion, opening up the period for lectures with readings of telegrams from those not in attendance. He began with a letter from the mayor, and then read a communique from the Wizard of Menlo Park.
To T.C. Martin, I'm sorry that I'm prevented from attending your annual dinner tonight, especially as I would like to pay my respects to Marconi, the young man who had the monumental audacity to attempt and succeed in jumping an electric wave clear across the Atlantic. Thomas A. Edison.
Martin did not announce that at Christmas Marconi had sent Edison a cheerful telegram reiterating his success and offering to display personally to the master his transatlantic equipment, or that Marconi was already tendering Edison offers for his early wireless patents. The New York Times reported cheers when the Toastmaster came to a letter from Nikola Tesla, who said that he could not rise to the occasion. No doubt they masked the jeers. Grinning through his oversized moustache, Martin waited for the clamour to subside before continuing with the rest of the letter. I regret not being able to contribute to the pleasure of the evening, but I wish to join the members in heartily congratulating Mr. Marconi on his brilliant results. He is a splendid worker, full of rare and subtle energies. May he prove to be one of those whose powers increase and whose mind feelers reach out farther with advancing years for the good of the world and honor of his country. Professor Elihu Thompson followed. I had received the news of Marconi's great feat from over the telephone from a reporter, who wished to know whether I believed that signals had actually been received across the Atlantic. Riding on the accolades of the audience, Thompson related his response. As I told the reporter, if Marconi says that he received the signals, I believe they were received. And then the hero took the pulpit. Waiting graciously for the applause to subside, he began. Signor Marconi explained his syntonic wireless system, and pointed out that he had built very largely on the work of others, and mentioned Clerk Maxwell, Lord Kelvin, Professor Henry, and Professor Hertz. At this time, its most important use was for communication between ships. The Italian was pleased to announce that over 70 ships now carried his wireless system, 37 for the British Navy, 12 for the Italian Navy, and the remainder on large liners such as the Cunard Line, the North German Lloyd, and the Beaver Line. There were also over 20 stations in operation, with more on construction. Marconi addressed the problem of selective tuning, and suggested he had such a system created so that messages transmitted from one ship can in no way be received by any other, except that attuned to receive the message. Stated as bravado, Marconi was bluffing, as he had no system for creating separate channels. "It is my hope," Signor Marconi concluded, "that at no great distant date
I shall bring my system to the point of perfection of allowing friends and relatives to communicate with each other across the ocean at a small expense. Professor Pupin concluded, referring to claims made that previous to Marconi, wireless signals have been transmitted over short distances, Pupin said, glancing back to the upper dais. Any schoolboy by means of a Hertzian oscillator could transmit such signals over a short distance, but it required the engineer to make such work of avail to the world. In attempting to allay fears that Marconi's system would make obsolete Atlantic cables, Dr. Pupin shrewdly pointed out as an illustration how the completion of electric lighting had aided the gas industry and enhanced rather than decreased the value of their investments. On January the 9th, Tesla dispatched a letter to Morgan explaining that the patents of the Marconi-Fleming Syndicate do not accurately reflect their actual apparatus, but are covered by my patents of 1896 and 1897. The balance of the letter describes the precursor to what becomes, a half-century later, the major television networks. I need not tell you that I have worked as hard as I have dared without collapsing. Having examined and rejected hundreds of experiments, with the capital at command, I am glad to say that by slow and steady advances, I have managed to continue a machine which shall produce an electrical disturbance of sufficient intensity to be perceptible over the whole of the earth. When I throw the switch, I shall send a greeting to the whole world, and for this great triumph, I shall ever be grateful to you. This system will do away not only with the cables, but with the newspapers also, for how can journals at the present stay in business when every customer can have a cheap machine printing its own world news? The beautiful invention which I am now developing will enable me to spread our name into every home, and it will be able everywhere to hear the tune of my voice. This would be the inventor's last communique to the financier for fully 9 months. He set himself the difficult task of completing construction of the 18-story transmission tower, knowing full well that he did not have sufficient funds. From bank records dating back to 1896, it is apparent that Tesla had nearly $50,000, some of which had been converted into land assets. The last of Morgan's money had probably been received, so it was at this time, in the midst of 1902, that the trailblazer began to tap his personal reserves to keep the project going. Work would continue at a steady pace throughout the year. Other competitors. Having received his doctorate in electrical engineering in 1899, Lee DeForest had tried once again to gain entree into his idol's laboratory, but for a third time, Tesla refused him. DeForest decided, therefore, to set out on his own. In 1901, he succeeded in sending wireless messages across the Hudson River over a distance of 1 or 2 miles, and shortly thereafter sent impulses from State Street in downtown New York to Staten Island, 7 miles away. By using self-restoring detectors with telephone receivers instead of Morse inkers or sounders, DeForest succeeded in increasing substantially the speed of transmission. Now his apparatus threatened Western Union's local telegraph lines. Working with D. McFarlane Moore, who had studied Tesla's monumental early volume, DeForest was able to decrease the problems of static interference. By 1903, he was reporting yacht races at a speed of 25 to 30 words per minute, or about as fast as a Morse code operator could send them. By 1904, he could transmit messages 180 miles over land between Buffalo and Cleveland, and by 1908, his signaling device was jumping continents. Perhaps it was because of Tesla's regard for the Yale graduate, or because of the canoness of his patents, that Tesla did not try to prevent DeForest from using his oscillators and general scheme. The same, however, could not be said for Reginald Fessenden, whom he sued for patent infringement in April 1902. Fessenden, who had worked for both Edison and Westinghouse as far back as the early 1980s, is generally credited with having invented the means of sending voice over the airwaves. Although Marconi was using the electromagnetic frequencies to mimic the impulse patterns of the Morse code, it occurred to Fessenden to send out a continuous signal with the amplitude of the waves varied or modulated to make the variation follow the irregularities of sound waves.
At the receiving station, these variations could be sorted out and reconverted into sound. In 1906, the first such message was sent out from the Massachusetts coast, and wireless receivers could actually pick up the music. In this way, radio, as we know it, was born. A year later, using his patented auction, which was in essence a modification of Tesla's brush tube, De Forest succeeded in transmitting the voice of Enrico Caruso, who was singing at the Metropolitan Opera House in New York. Interested, for reasons of priority, in obtaining Edison's Grasshopper wireless patent, dating from the 1880s, Fessenden sought a job with GE in 1902 to inaugurate construction of a wireless transmitting station at Brant Rock, Massachusetts. Although he stayed friendly with Edison and looked after his wayward son Tom Jr., who'd been caught passing bad checks, Fessenden was unsuccessful in obtaining Edison's key wireless patent. The Menlo Park Wizard had sold it to Marconi for $60,000. Legal entanglements were expensive, but Tesla felt that he had no choice but to protect as many fundamental aspects of his system as he was able to. How else could he prove to Morgan that his work in the field really was the basis of the systems that were succeeding? In June 1900, Reginald Fessenden had applied for a patent on tuned circuits. The following month, Tesla filed for one as well. It was a matter of public record that Fessenden's application preceded Tesla's. What was at issue was whether or not Fessenden had compiled his invention from Tesla's earlier experiments. Although Fessenden claimed that he had conceived the idea in 1898, Tesla pointed out that Fessenden was, 1, unable to provide documentation of this earlier date, 2, he did not create a working model of his apparatus, and 3, the machine had not been used commercially. Whereas Fessenden's application was rudimentary, Tesla's delineated clearly a multiplicity of goals. For example, 1, operating distant apparatus, 2, controlling signals by using two or more idiosyncratic electrical frequencies, 3, producing a plurality of distinctive impulses onto a receiving apparatus comprising a manifold number of circuits, and 4, creating a combination transmitter-receiver arrangement set up to respond to a succession of impulses released in a given order. Whereas Fessenden could date his theoretical conceptualizations to perhaps 1898, Tesla dated the onset of his work to 1889 and provided his numerous publications as evidence. With specific reference to the operation of tuned circuits, the inventor displayed his fully working teleautomaton, which he introduced to the world in 1898. Without Tesla's AC oscillators, Fessenden's machinery could not operate. Unless he had lived in a hermitage, it would have been impossible for Fessenden to have conceived his invention without utilizing Tesla's attainments. Parker W. Page questioned his client for hours. Tesla's testimony would run 72 typewritten pages. Throughout mid-April, the testimony continued, and after Tesla was finished, his 29-year-old manager, George Scherf, took the stand. Scherf, who was living at Wardenclyffe by this time, was able to substantiate that Tesla's tuned circuits and long-distance wireless experiments were first conducted in his presence in 1895, when he began working for Tesla at his laboratory at 33-35 South Fifth Avenue, before it burned to the ground. Scherf remembered the inventor transmitting wireless impulses from the Houston Street lab to the roof of the Hotel Gerlach, which was 1 or 2 miles away. Fritz Lowenstein, just a year younger than Scherf, followed. Having returned from Europe in February and newly married, Lowenstein had gained re-employment with Tesla at Wardenclyffe. In a heavy German accent, Lowenstein thoroughly described the nature of the confidential experiments at Colorado Springs. "Mr. Tesla explained to me," Lowenstein stated, "that the chief feature of a practical wireless telegraph system was the secrecy, immunity, and selectivity. At the same time, he explained to me how two oscillations are secured from one oscillating apparatus. When I came to Mr. Tesla," the college-educated engineer revealed, "I didn't understand anything at all about it, but he soon showed me the great value of tuned circuits, and then I understood what tuning was." "Dear Mr. Scherf, Mr. Page has just told me that my opponent's attorney has admitted my priority. Mr. Fessenden must be disappointed, of course,
and I'm sorry for him, although, you know, he has written some articles which are not very nice. My honour as the originator of the principle is assured.
Tesler may have won the case, but he was not about to celebrate. Foremost among his priorities